This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear surgeon in New York City and New Jersey.
I'm Marina Kurian. As you guys know, she's always trying to trip me up at the beginning of the show. So anyway, I'm a general surgeon and I do weight loss and other minimally invasive surgery in New York City. We have a great show today.
We do. And you know what, Marina? It's the first week of prep that I have not been nervous because we finally get to talk about something I actually know something about.
You know a lot about a lot, as we all know, but from the show, from all these weeks of doing it. But it's exciting. And actually, Sujana didn't know this, but I almost went into ENT and I didn't. But that would have been so weird. Then this would have been the ENT show.
That would have been awesome. We are going to talk about hearing health, hearing aids, cochlear implants, listening to music, playing music, what happens to our brains. We have two wonderful guests today. Dr. Shelly Chadha is the WHO's, the World Health Organization's Director of Programs for Hearing Loss and Deafness, for the prevention of hearing loss and deafness. And Dr. Charles Lim is a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, the director of their Cochlear Implant Center, and the president of elect of the American Auditory Society, and a quite famous music and the brain researcher, as well as cochlear implant surgeon. We're going to meet them in a few minutes. Please like and share and tag your friends, anybody who cares about listening and music.
And hearing.
And hearing.
We all care about hearing. Actually, it's so funny. I mean, it impacts so many of us. So this show is going to be wonderful to see and hear. And it's also closed captioned on Facebook. It's an important show because it affects everything. Like Sujana actually sees my parents for hearing loss. They both refuse to wearing hearing aids. So I think that's an abject failure on her part. But whatever. You know, we'll work through this. But we, as you guys know, we do talk of the news of the week. And this week has been like really very important in medicine. A lot of great things have happened for people. And it's also like every great thing, there's some sadness attached to it as well. But this was National Match Week. National Match Day is one day, but there are some people that don't match. So, you know, we have to do what we call the scramble that whole week. But Suju, let's talk a little bit about what's happening on this slide.
Right. So for those who don't know, to become a doctor, you have to go to medical school. Then you have to apply for and match into a residency program. And only then can you practice as a physician. So you apply into whatever field you like, for example, general surgery for Marina, ENT surgery for me. In fact, 6.5% of matriculants match to psychiatry this year, which is an all-time high for them. There were over 42,000 students applying for only 38,000 positions. So on Monday, they found out if they matched. And then on Friday this past week, they found out where they matched. And in that interim, the students who did not match did something called SOAP, which is Supplemental Offer and Acceptance Program, where they re-interviewed at places that had open slots and tried to match there. There's something called a scramble, where you're just furiously tapping on your keyboard, sort of like trying to get a COVID shot, but trying to get a job so you can do what you've been trained to do. And we have this graphic from NRMP, which is the National Resident Matching Program. And it shows five applicants four of whom matched and one of whom didn't, despite how this particular person ranked. So there's actually a video on there if you want to understand it better. NRMP.org has a really interesting video. That's what this picture is from. But this is such a happy time for so many people. And unfortunately, as Marina said, frustrating for others.
Right. And I think the important thing is, you know, everybody has a strategy for the match. You go through, you have an advisor in med school who tells you what to do. And I ended up ranking, I think, like 12 or 13 programs to match at one, right? And in some scenarios, people only rank one, but they're not supposed to. You can't actually tell them, listen, you're number one. There's a lot of stuff you're not supposed to do, but that kind of does happen behind the scenes. But when you're the one scrambling, it can be life-changing. And we've had some prior guests from our show who actually didn't match at their first choice in terms of career. And well, these are actually our prior guests who did match exactly where they wanted to, which is so wonderful. Both the students London and Carmen matched in where they wanted to match, which was wonderful. But our prior guests, Valerie Fitzhugh, or at Dr. FNA, and Agnieszka Solberg, who is an interventional radiologist, they both initially didn't actually match in their desired choice. And what they did is, you know, that whole phrase, which can sound really annoying after a while, if life gives you lemons, make lemonade. I mean, I think that this is something that you do when you take a detour from where you thought your trajectory was. It's how you traverse that and how you manage it that really ultimately determines your career. And those are the two that didn't start off on their path. They ended up where they want to be and completely happy. Sujit, you didn't know this, but I also, once you do your medical school match, there's other matches, fellowship match, right? So yep. I did general surgery and then I entered the ped surgery match like three times. And I didn't match in pediatric surgery, but what happened is I bumped into one of my classmates from med school and he said, don't do ped surg, do laparoscopic surgery. And I was like, are you sure? I really like to touch stuff. You know, like when I operate, I like to touch things like the organs and stuff. I know that sounds creepy, but we're surgeons. I like to, anyway. So he was like, no, trust me, you're going to love it. And if it hadn't been for him, I would have had a completely different trajectory, right? So even I had experienced what was considered adversity, but really changed my life completely. I mean, I'm so happy where I am and happenstance, but it's also what you make of it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the match is slightly crazy or super crazy. I matched in my fellowship before the match, which was even crazier because then it was, you know, you better tell me by 5 p.m. today, you better do this, you better do that. So there has to be a better way. There also have to be enough slots. You know, we've talked before that kids are graduating $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 in debt. For them to graduate medical school and then not be able to do their internship year so they can't actually work as physicians is really crazy. So we have a graph that shows that the number of medical students is much higher than the available number of residency spots, which is the PGY1, which is the postgraduate year one spot. And so the American Association of Medical Colleges is really asking the Center for Medicare and Medicaid, which kind of sets these numbers, and the national government to increase the slots for residency so that all of these very highly trained medical students can go on to practice. But let's switch gear and talk a little bit about COVID before we meet our guests.
Well, no, we're going to talk just about COVID vaccines. How exciting, right? Like, yes. Let's look at what's happening now. We actually surpassed in, I think, 58 days, 100 million doses that the current administration wanted to get out there. So that's really fantastic news. But we have a graph also looking at our worldwide, what the dosing is being. And this is, you know, it speaks to inequity. Obviously, there are many countries that don't even have any shots in hand yet. Our goal is in to cover 75% of the population in the U.S. So that's good. But let's just talk quickly about the Canadian situation, Sujana.
Right. So in Canada, so normally if you get a Pfizer vaccine, you're supposed to get the second one 3 weeks later. If you get a Moderna vaccine, you get the second one 4 weeks later, and then Johnson and Johnson is the single shot. But in Canada, they are actually delaying the second shot of the two that need two up to 4 months or at 4 months, because they want to get everyone a single shot. We're not sure about the science behind that. There was a study showing the efficacy of even a single shot in England. They looked at a number of elderly patients. They sort of mapped out what would happen if for a group of elderly who didn't get a shot at all, and then a group of elderly who got one shot, and the rate of hospitalization and death and severe disease is significantly less with even the one shot. But we'll have to see whether the Canadian delay of 4 months is science or a weird social experiment.
Okay. We
On
have to switch
that
gears, right? We're going to
note,
switch gears and talk about science, really, and what can be done in public health. And so joining us again is our guest, Dr. Shelly Chadha, who is the WHO director or the WHO director for programs for the prevention of deafness and hearing loss, and Dr. Charles Lim, professor and chief of otology at UCSF and president-elect of the American Auditory Society, will be talking about hearing health, hearing loss, how noise can damage your hearing, cochlear implants, and our brains on music, not drugs. Welcome, you guys.
We're so happy to have you here, reminding our viewers that we are live on Facebook, where we are live closed captioned, on Twitter, on YouTube, on Scroll.in, and on Sri's LinkedIn page. We will be broadcast on WBAI.org from 2 to 3 p.m. on Eastern Time on Monday. So we're really happy to meet Dr. Chadha and Dr. Lim, and maybe we'll just get started right away. Let's start with how the ear works. So maybe Shelley, can you just explain to us what happens from out here in? And then Charles, I'm going to have you pick it up and tell us what happens in the brain.
Right. So thanks, Sujana, for that question. And thank you, of course, for having me on the show. So putting it in a very simple way, the sound waves, they're picked up by this beautiful shell-shaped structure, which we often use for adorning ourselves. But the real purpose of this is to capture the sound waves and direct them inside our ear canal, as you see on this diagram here. And what the sound waves do then is they come to the end of this canal and they hit the eardrum, also known as the tympanic membrane in medical language. So for those who are familiar with that terminology, so it hits the eardrums and causes it to vibrate. And behind the eardrum sit three little bones, and these are the tiniest bones in the human body. Actually, one of them, the stapes, is just as a trivia, which may be interesting to for some, is the smallest bone in the human body, actually. So the vibrations of this eardrum, they cause these bones also to vibrate. And then these vibrations are conveyed to what you see here, just marked in purple. That is the cochlea, that shell-shaped structure is the cochlea. And cochlea contains fluid. So this fluid also starts to vibrate along with the vibrations of the bones. And this causes movement of tiny little hair cells, which are tiny little hairs which are there inside our cochlea. So, our cochlea contains thousands and thousands of these little hair cells which vibrate. And this vibration is actually converted into an electrical stimulus, which is picked up by the auditory nerve and then carried to the through the brainstem and into the brain. And
So,
I'll hand over to Dr. Lim to explain what happens in the brain.
and I want to show you because I have a giant ear here. I have a gianter ear behind me, but this is the ear canal. This is the eardrum. That's the middle ear. And then this is that inner ear that Dr. Chadha was talking about. The cochlea is the thing that looks like a snail here. And then those are the nerves that carry to the brain. So, Charles, what happens in our brains?
Sure. Thank you. It's
You know,
kind of
wait,
an
before Charles, I
amazing.
just want to say one thing. she just pulled out that model. Like, I want to go to her house now. I just want to see what else she has there. Okay. Like, oh, look, by the way, sorry, please continue.
Yeah, everybody should have one of those in their house. But, you know, I think it's an amazing concept that vibrations in the end are perceived as an acoustical percept. And what's really happening is a reconstructive process in your brain. And so if you think about acoustics of sound ending essentially at the cochlea, you can think of everything thereafter as being electrical in nature. And so your actual ability to hear a sound, whatever that sound is no longer vibrational or, you know, is really sound-based once it hits the nerve. At that point, all of this electricity is going down the auditory nerve and is hitting the brainstem. There are centers in the auditory brain that funnel the sound. They preserve things like pitch in terms of high pitch, low pitch, and each part of the brain starts processing that sound, and it sends it higher and higher up, where it goes first into the brainstem and then into what's called the primary auditory cortex and then what's called secondary auditory areas. And in the end, you have this auditory experience, which can be any number of things and can have any number of impacts on you, where the brain is processing that in different ways depending on the relevance of the signal. Pretty remarkable process.
Can you explain what's happening, Charles, in this slide? Like,
sure.
We're looking, you know, one of your avenues of research is music and the effect on the brain. And I have no idea what you're doing in this slide. So please explain to me.
Yeah. So I use functional MRI scanning, which is a way to test or to measure blood flow in the brain real time during certain activities. And one of the great mysteries for the field, but also for me personally, has always been how it's possible that the brain can perceive or hear music, but not just how it can hear it, but how it can produce it. And so in this experiment, what I was doing was having jazz musicians improvise, meaning create music spontaneously in the fMRI scanner. And the purpose of this was to essentially measure the creative brain in action live. And so the scans that we're showing are really blood flow changes that are linked to changes in electricity in the brain. So areas that are red or yellow are hot spots, and areas that are blue are cold spots. And one of the amazing things in this figure is that when musicians start to go creative, there's a big cold spot that hits the front part of the brain in what's called the frontal lobe or the prefrontal cortex. And in that part of the brain, at least for these expert musicians, it appears like the brain is sort of shutting itself off in its conscious self-monitoring and effortful planning areas in order to allow for spontaneous creativity.
That's really cool. So that means that when they're creating, and I have to say that you designed this amazing keyboard that can work in an fMRI without any metal in it, but when people are creative, their inhibitions go away. Is that what that's showing us?
I think for really trained experts, that's in a way maybe part of the goal, is to get out of your own way. And I think for people that are learning or amateurs, they actually have a hard time with that. And so that may be one of the hallmarks of really high level creativity. But I do think that there's all different forms of creativity, and this work is really just beginning. On the other hand, we now have tools that actually allow us to ask these questions and maybe try to answer them in a reasonable way.
Just so people understand, that the MRI is a big magnet, and if you bring metal in it, that's a disaster of epic proportions. So Charles actually built, you know, you might be on an FBI watch list, sir, if you know how to build things that are metal and, you know, you can sneak things in places. So, but you built that without any metal in it. I think that's just a really amazing. Sujana was like, isn't that amazing? I'm like, I don't know. Let me think about it. Yes, it's amazing. Really well done. And functional MRI has been used for so many different things. We use it in diagnosis of obesity. It's used also in addiction to see like what parts of the brain light up. It's actually a great way to really ascertain how the brain's working and in reaction to different things, right? So it's really wonderful way to use that device or whatever, that procedure, to really identify what's happening for patients.
So I think we'll pull it back a little bit and just talk about hearing loss across the world. And, you know, the World Health Organization has really done amazing work identifying the scope of this problem and why it's important, and trying to find the ways we can intervene to make that graph that's going up in terms of hearing loss across the world flatten and go down. So Shelley, maybe you can talk to us a bit about what the WHO has found.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Sujana. And you're right about these recent findings, which we've published just a couple of weeks back in the World Report on Hearing, which is that globally about 1.5 billion people have hearing loss. And this number, it has been rising in the past decades, and it is likely that this will continue to rise. If the current trends continue the way things are, it continues. And out of this 1.5 billion people, what WHO estimates is that about a third of them, so nearly 500 million, actually need, actively require services and intervention in order to have good functioning in their day-to-day life. So that is something. And I can go, if you like, into the reasons why this graph is going up and so on, but I'll hand back to you to let me know when you want me to do that.
Sure. Now's a good time.
Yeah.
So thanks. And of course, the reason why the number is going to go on increasing, you know, from 1.5 billion to 2.5 in 2050 is because, well, there will be more humans living on this planet in 2050. There will be nearly 10 billion of us, or just short of 10 billion is what is projected. But the reason is that, of course, is the change in the demography. We will have more humans, and we are living longer. We are living, growing older. So the world populations are aging. So that also contributes to this increase in numbers. But what is also important here is to are the risk factors. The risk factors for hearing loss, which are on one hand persisting, and some risk factors which are also increasing. So when I talk about risk factors which are persisting, these are risk factors like ear infections, you know, common ear infections, which are very common in many parts of the world. They are persisting because people do not have access to the services. But also what is on rise, and a risk factor which we didn't have so much prior to the last, I would say this last decade, is listening to loud music over our headphones and earphones. So with the easy access to listening to music through our devices, this is a risk factor which is currently also on the rise. And while music is really, it is so essential for us, not just for our, just for, enjoyment and recreation, but even for mental health, it is amazing. But when heard at very loud levels, it leads to hearing loss. And this hearing loss is completely irreversible. It is, however, preventable. So that's one of the things which is driving up this.
So Shelley, is it that since the Walkman, right? I don't know. Most people don't know what the Walkman is, but I think but since the Walkman, since I have earbuds in now, but I don't ever use these really, except sometimes when I'm working out, I pop them in. I don't listen to music like that. I like to blare it in my car. But is it worse because the headphones are here and people are maybe not using appropriate levels, or you want to hear certain things really loud? Or is it also that it's just so close to your ear? And then the last question is, those particular earbuds that like really fit and are noise canceling, are they better for you?
Okay, thanks. Thanks for those questions, Marina. So the proximity of the earphones to the ears, it contributes in a sense that it makes it private, and it's only in your ears. You don't have any, attenuation. If you're listening to music through a speaker, then there will be some attenuation, some reduction in intensity if you're sitting far away. So yes, in that way. But ultimately, I think the the problem lies that, yes, people do like to listen to music a little loud. And sometimes it's not even that they like to listen to it like that. They just get used to listening to it like that. And very often people have to turn up the volume because there's so much background noise around them because they're in a train or in a bus and they can't hear their music unless they turn it up really loud. So that's where the noise canceling headphones are actually useful. So they can, or earphones, they are useful because they reduce the need to drive the volume up. So in that way, that's helpful, yes.
We have a viewer named Jan Myers who's asking about the relationship of hearing loss and dementia. So Charles, let's talk a bit about what happens to adults with untreated hearing loss. Maybe all the things that they are potentially facing if they're not diagnosed and then they're not treated. And by treatment, we mean, you know, hearing aids, removing earwax, fixing their eardrum, whatever the treatment involves.
Yeah, very important topic. Thank you for the question. You know, I think in recent years, maybe in the past 10 to 20 years, there's been a growing emphasis on understanding the relationship between hearing loss and aging, and in particular with healthy aging. And there's been a lot of important work that's showing very important associations between hearing loss and decline in certain cognitive and other, well-being parameters later in life. And so the actual impact of this, if you kind of go through it medically, psychologically, financially, I mean, it's astonishing how much hearing loss seems to matter for things like cognition. And I think it sort of speaks to the fact that hearing loss has been an under-recognized or underappreciated limitation for many people, and that there are simple things that can be in place that will drastically, we hope, reduce the impact of this hearing loss on these other brain faculties that are declining. And so it is certainly, I think, preventable and treatable. And there's so much that can be done that's quite easy to reduce the potential damaging impacts of hearing loss on the brain.
You know, we, you know, like cardiologists use EKGs, ear doctors use audiograms. So we actually want to compare apples to apples when we're talking to people. So when we have our colleagues in audiology do a proper hearing test on somebody, we have a graph just showing what normal hearing is up to about the ability to hear sounds across a range of frequencies to about 25 decibels. And then we have mild hearing loss, moderate, moderately severe, severe, and profound hearing loss. And I think each of these is treated differently. There's also different types of hearing loss. So Shelley, maybe you can talk to us about what's the difference between a conductive hearing loss and a sensory neural hearing loss. And I have to tell you, when we were preparing for the show, this was Marina's point. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. People don't know this either.
Well, so, it's because I have a conductive hearing loss. This has been a great show. Like, it's so funny because she thought it was all about her. And I was like, oh, no. This show is actually about me. So anyway, please, yeah. Shelley.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Marina. I also wanted to comment on the question which somebody posed about the relation between hearing loss and dementia. Actually, this Lancet Commission on Dementia, which was published a couple of years back, what it showed was that hearing loss in adults is the single most common modifiable risk factor which predisposes to dementia. So what that means is that by taking care of hearing loss in older in adults, essentially, and making sure that they do not face its impact, we can reduce the onset of dementia in people as they age. So I just wanted to add that. But coming back to your point, Marina, about the severity of hearing loss and also what it means. So really, if you look at mild hearing loss, that commonly remains undetected because people may not even notice that they have this hearing loss. The only time when it may bother them is when they're in a noisy restaurant and are talking to a group of friends and they can't make out clearly what someone is saying. So that could just be the kind of problem an individual faces. And those who have moderate or moderately severe hearing loss have increasingly more difficulty in routine conversations. So they may have problems if they're in a meeting or if they are just sitting and conversing normally to be able to understand and to be able to, hear and to be able to understand what that person is saying. The severity increases, this difficulty increases till we reach profound hearing loss where a person may not be able to hear anything. This is the conductive type of hearing loss, which is mostly mild or moderate or could be moderately severe. It is usually caused due to problems in that eardrum and the little bones that we spoke about earlier. So that is where the problem lies, either in the external part of the ear or in the middle part of the ear. Whereas the sensory neural hearing loss, as the name itself applies, the problem usually lies either at the level of the cochlea, so the sensory part of the ear, or at the level of the nerve, the auditory nerve. So that is the difference between the two.
So we have this graphic that's very complicated, but it shows sort of what Shelley was talking about, where it's an ear canal or eardrum or middle ear problem is a conductive or more mechanical problem, whereas an inner ear and nerve and brain problem is more of a what we call sensory neural or nerve hearing loss. And again, Marina, the obesity surgeon, pointed out to me that we use tuning forks. So, Charles, what can you do with a 512 hertz tuning fork other than tune those beautiful instruments behind you?
Yeah, I know it's we're pretty good at getting information out of tuning forks that would surprise some people. But when you hear a tuning fork, it's putting out what's something that's known as a pure tone. So it's essentially one frequency vibrating. That's sort of the beauty of it. It's a kind of thing that's not commonly found in nature other than in a tuning fork and in a synthesizer. And what you're doing is testing the ability of the body to hear either through the actual normal ear canal eardrum, which is called air conduction, or you actually physically put the vibrating tuning fork on the patient's body, usually on the mastoid bone, which is sitting right behind the ear, or potentially you could put it on the forehead or any number of other places in the body to see if the sound is being conducted by bone conduction. And if you have a significant conductive hearing loss, you'll do something that's called flipping your forks, which is where suddenly the sound will be louder through the bone than through the air. In normal situations, because your hearing conduction is very effective, you hear best through your ear canal and eardrum.
How about screening? How are we screening for this? You know, I remember doing this in school, and I know you're supposed to do it when you're younger. I don't know if they did it. I mean, we did it. I also did some pediatric critical care, and when with the babies, we would do the little, you know, trying to get them to make little noises by their ears. But that wasn't our shtick, right? Like, but we just did something as part of screening. But I know I went through it in school, probably because I had a little lisp, which I kind of still have for different reasons. But that is one form of screening. But when do you then subsequently screen people, other than when I call Sujana and tell her that my parents are deaf and they won't listen to me because they can't hear me? but when what is the screening process for children and also adults?
So I'll tell you, I think we... you know, we have universal newborn hearing screening in the United States across just about every state, I think. That's not present in much of the rest of the world. So Marina's right. The earlier we can screen and identify hearing issues, the better the kids will do. Maybe, Charles, we talked a bit about what happens to adults with hearing loss. Can you tell us what children face if they have untreated hearing loss? And there is a question about what do we do about single-sided hearing loss? And I think that question is different in children and adults as well.
Yes. So the issue of children with hearing loss is, you know, hugely devastating for many, many children and families. And I think it's very crucial, I think, to know how frequently we see, you can see from this slide, how many children are going to have hearing issues. And because it's not one of these immediately visible situations, it's often under-recognized, even by a child's family, and certainly the child themselves often can't advocate for themselves. And so as we learn more about this, we're realizing that it's a huge problem that we have globally, where children that are being born with hearing loss then have a sort of domino effect of issues that affect their speech development and their cognitive development and their ability to sort of function in these school environments that really rely on the ability to hear well. And so there's often an assumption that people have normal hearing. Now, when you think about the sort of screening processes that are in place, hopefully the net result of all of this will be greater awareness of the need for better hearing services, better hearing testing. But also, I think a sense that it shouldn't just be the kind of thing that you evaluate when somebody has an obvious problem. Sometimes by the time a patient is aware that they've had a major problem, it's really a lot of damage has already been done, and things could have been prevented if you had intervened sooner. And so it's my hope that what will eventually happen is that not only will patients come in when they've, you know, had a catastrophic change in hearing, but there's a routine concept of getting your hearing evaluated, sort of like a well hearing check, where you can get a sense of the status of your hearing, whether you're a child or an adult.
You know, I think that is terrific. I think like everything else, screening and early intervention really helps. Shelley, the World Health Organization has this sort of acronym, HEARING, that really talks about all the ways we can intervene before, during, and subsequently when there's a hearing loss. Maybe you can talk to us about that, because it's not only all of the social and medical burdens that we've talked about, but there's a huge economic burden to having untreated hearing loss.
Indeed. In the report I mentioned earlier, Sujana, WHO estimated that unaddressed hearing loss is actually costing the world $980 billion each year. So this was what it cost the world in 2019. And of course, depend as the numbers go on increasing, this cost could very well go on rising. So WHO has proposed a package of interventions which looks at hearing loss. It takes a life course perspective, and what this package, which is acronymized, not very innovatively, as the hearing package of interventions, it talks about is firstly the starting point, which is hearing screening and early intervention. So for babies and children, for children in school, also for adults who are at higher risk of hearing loss. So hearing screening for adults who are in occupational, who face occupational noise or are exposed to chemicals, which can, lead to hearing loss at work. And then also in older adults. So as a means of identifying hearing loss early and then making sure we follow it up with interventions. In addition to this, it talks about ear disease prevention and management. So because I mentioned that ear infections are a very important and avoidable cause of hearing loss. Then it talks about access to technologies, because once hearing loss has been identified, you need to rehabilitate with the use of hearing technology and then with rehabilitation services. It also talks about, access to sign language as well as to services like captioning, which is so vital for people who have hearing loss to be able to access information. It talks about noise control, and it talks also about something that I think we really need to talk more about, which is greater community engagement. And this is what we consider a key component of addressing hearing loss, which is to address the stigma which surrounds hearing loss. But I'm going to stop here.
So I'll tell you, I think that leads really well into the concept of hearing aids and personal sound amplification products. We have a question about why Medicare, which covers elderly people in the United States, does not cover hearing aids.
Yeah.
I wish I had an answer. I wish I had an answer why medical students can't get jobs. I wish I had an answer why Medicare mm-hmm. won't cover an absolutely needed service, which we have learned today will prevent the progression and onset of dementia in the vast majority of people who need hearing aids. But can we talk a bit about the different types of hearing aids that are available? We have a little graphic showing the different sizes. And I'm going to ask Shelley about this, because then we're going to go on to cochlear implants, and I'm going to ask Charles about that.
Sure. So hearing aids, of course, come in different forms and shapes, and maybe this graphic can help people to see what are the kind of shapes they come in. And the shape that you choose will depend upon, well, how comfortable you are with these shapes, both in terms of its cosmesis, but also in handling these. So it can be a behind the ear hearing aid, like you see on the right side, with an ear mold, or it can be in the ear hearing aid, like you see, and then in the canal, which are not even visible. But what is more important is the technology which is within these hearing aids, which is really digital hearing aids. So we have very few now analog hearing aids. By and large, it is digital technology. And the hearing aids can be programmed to suit the to match the hearing loss, so the shape of the audiogram which you saw earlier. So they can be programmed according to the shape of the audiogram so that the user can have full benefit from these hearing aids.
Shelley, there are outreach efforts all over the world. I know Sujan is involved with a group that goes out, and we have a slide of one from Nicaragua. Can we talk about how audiology services are rolled out around the world, and what are the options for countries that, you know, maybe not have the resources that we have here?
Mm-hmm. So the World Report on Hearing actually talks about all these problems. So maybe I can also post a link to that. It's a big report, but there are summaries and then a summary of the summary, so people may browse through whatever they are able to. But essentially, it talks about a lot of these problems, because as you've mentioned, what we face is that a huge lack of human resources. So both human resources as well as services for hearing care and for ear diseases as well are lacking in, well, you saw on the earlier slide that 80% of those who have hearing loss live in low and middle income countries of the world. And this is where these services are commonly lacking, because human resources are lacking. There is often also not that demand for these services because of the lack of awareness in the society. So what this World Report proposes are ways in which governments can act within their, well, they have to allocate resources to this, but also it is about making sure that there are human resources, and they don't always have to be highly trained human resources. So it talks about strategies like task sharing. So how can, carders with lesser training undertake some of the tasks and share them with the more highly trained resources like ENT doctors and audiologists? Because in many of the countries, there is one audiologist serving the needs of 5 million people or more. So it talks about these strategies. It also talks about strategies like, telehealth. So telehealth and how this can bridge this gap. So how can countries act within the current situation and context to bridge this gap in services? And there's a lot of innovation in our field, both in terms of technology, so a lot of digital innovations for screening. So screening can actually take place. You talked about newborn hearing screening, but screening can be done also in any situation, in clinical and community settings, because of all the digital technology. And what we are trying to promote through this World Report is also innovation in service delivery, so that we can develop these in countries and provide services to those who are in need of them.
You know, you answered a question as you were talking. Catherine Parr, who is a student at the University of Pennsylvania, asked a question about equitable access for hearing technology in the rest of the world. And I think this is really important. One of the issues is batteries, right? So we need hearing aids that are solar charged, because where are you going to pick up a battery in certain when there's one audiologist for 5 million people? Let's shift a little. We talked a bit about those hair cells, and we talked about the loss of those hair cells that happens with noise exposure and with aging. And we have a hole mount section of two cochleas, two inner ears, that I got from the late Dr. Myron Shapiro. And this shows on the left, the black is staining all of those hair cells in a 17-year-old boy's inner ear. And you can see that it's full of black, pretty hair cells. And then on the right, you see a 72-year-old man who worked in a noisy industry. And you can see that almost all of those hair cells are gone. And when that person can no longer benefit from a hearing aid, Charles, what is an option for that person in order to be able to continue to hear and communicate?
Yeah, so one of the most amazing, really a medical miracle of our generation is the fact that cochlear implants have become commonplace. And so a cochlear implant is a device that takes over where the acoustic hearing fails. And so if you have a problem where hearing aids are just not powerful enough to sort of overcome the deficit of neurons that are lacking or hair cells that have been damaged, the cochlear implant is a wire, a complicated wire electrode that gets inserted into the inner ear and electrically stimulates the neurons that then go on to deliver the electrical energy to the brainstem and so forth. And so it's a really ingenious idea, but it's also, I think, astonishingly simple that it could work. And the reason why, you know, it's surprising. To date, there's no FDA-approved drugs for hearing loss, which is just a remarkable fact. Yet, we also have the, if you had to lose any sensory modality, we're the furthest along in medicine with hearing. And so that duality or that dichotomy is very kind of striking. And part of the reason why sticking a wire into the inner ear works is because the inner ear has a spatial organization. It's physically organized in a way that makes itself amenable to electricity being delivered in an organized way. So the high pitches are taking place in that part of the inner ear that's called the base, the widest turn of that cochlea. And as you get, if you kind of go up the spiral of the inner ear, as you get to the apex or the very sort of top point of it, the frequencies are getting lower and lower in pitch, more bass-like. And that kind of mathematical organization of the inner ear can be mimicked by these electrodes that are delivering the sound in a sort of frequency-specific way. And the end result of that is that you have relatively good preservation of that information, exactly, relatively good preservation of that information when you get it back to the brain. Now, you could just compare the electrode design of any cochlear implant to the neurons of the inner ear and the hair cells of the inner ear, and you know right away it's not as sophisticated as the native ear. So we have a long way to go, but these implant designs are amazing technology, and you can absolutely transform somebody's life who's been deaf and struggling with hearing loss and hearing aids.
So, and this can be used also for people who are born deaf, right?
Correct. So there's many different applications. You can be a congenitally born
deaf. And when do you intervene? Because like I was at Lenox Hill in New York and at NYU, and both of them do, like, if there's like agenesis of the ear, they'll rebuild and reconstruct an ear, but there's also obviously putting in the cochlear implant. But what's that timing like, Charles?
So theoretically, the earlier the better. So if you're an infant, you really want to be implanted as soon as you can. Now, there's FDA guidelines of either 6 months or 12 months, depending on which company you're using. But around a year or so is about the age you'd want to implant a child. And there was a question about senior citizens. Absolutely. The oldest person I've implanted is 96 years old. But as long as somebody can medically handle a two-hour outpatient procedure and have the sort of wherewithal to understand what is taking place with respect to the device, almost anybody can get the cochlear implant if they qualify from a hearing perspective and benefit from it significantly.
I love those videos of, when babies can start to hear, right? Like, and they hear their mother and just that joy. I mean, it's heartbreakingly beautiful when you see that.
Yeah. And just to tie to tie together the earlier conversations, it's actually music that is pointing out some of the limitations of cochlear implants. They're very good at speech and they're really designed for speech. And it suggests that speech is a more uniform, in a way, easier signal for a cochlear implant device to transmit, whereas something like music is just, I think, orders of magnitude more complicated. And it shows, in a way, how far we have to go to obtain perfect hearing with something like a cochlear implant. But hopefully that's down on the horizon where one day we can really restore natural hearing.
What's the cost of a cochlear implant, like US and worldwide? I would imagine it's very expensive.
It is expensive. You know, the devices themselves, you know, there's obviously different cost to build and cost to purchase it, but it's many thousands of dollars, on the order of about $25,000 to $35,000 to actually purchase the device, typically from the companies. And then there's surgical anesthetic costs, so forth. But if you compare that to the number that we just saw, that huge cost of untreated hearing loss that Shelley was discussing, if you compare those costs to the, you know, tremendous issues of hearing loss, it's a really very small amount of money.
You know, I just, because my house is so awesome, I wanted to show you guys, this is an in-the-ear hearing aid, an in-the-canal hearing aid. That's the size of it. And then this is the external. So the cochlear implant has an internal part and an external part. So the external part sits on the ear like this and goes behind and attaches with connects with a magnet that's on the inside. So the technology, as Charles says, was really cool. It is expensive, but the return on investment of expending that amount of money is remarkable. And I think, Shelley, you wanted to point out that this is not a license to go and abuse your ears with noise.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Sujana. Because, of course, we are blessed that we have the miracle of cochlear implant as an option for people who lose their hearing or who are born without hearing. However, it remains out of reach for a lot of the world's population currently because of the cost and also because of the human resources, the audiology required around it, the rehabilitation which must accompany. And it is, for anybody who goes down that path, it is a fairly intense treatment to undergo. So I just wanted to point that out, that it should not be considered as an easy fix for, and I think it's important to take care of our hearing and hearing loss. The one, as Sujana showed in an industrial worker, 72 years old, and how his hearing, his or her hearing, you know, cells were kind of just gone. And it's important to know that we can prevent this. We can avoid this from happening by protecting our ears. So the music that we spoke about earlier, listening to loud music, that is what is what this is going to lead to. and as Charles also mentioned, I think if even a cochlear implant cannot bring those musical notes back, it can to a certain extent for sure, but that clarity of sound which your natural ears give you, a cochlear implant till now is not able to provide. And of course, cochlear implants are evolving, and I'm sure in the future they will be able to do that. But it is possible to prevent that hearing loss. And WHO actually estimates that 1 billion people are at risk of hearing loss simply because of the way they are listening to music. And we want to really prevent that. And of course, if people still develop hearing loss, there are amazing technologies like cochlear implants and hearing aids available for them.
You know, some of the most, we talked about people listening to loud music, but many of my family are rock musicians. So there's a significant amount of hearing loss there. And actually probably the most famous person, not rock musician, but played loud music was, you know, probably Beethoven, who was deaf at the end of his life, right? So it's just listening to music is one thing, but also performing and creating can have its impact as well. We had a question from Tom Etchery about whether insurance companies actually cover cochlear implants. Is that universal? Is that like a universal coverage decision, or is it really very specific to certain insurances? In the US, obviously. Actually, maybe the NHS. Do you guys know if the NHS or it's covered in Canada?
So it's in the United States, most insurances, including Medicare, will cover cochlear implants, especially if you have hearing in both ears. Implants are covered for single-sided deafness by many insurance companies, but not yet by Medicare. The National Health Service absolutely covers cochlear implants in England because, again, the return on investment is huge. When you go from deaf to hearing with an implant, you're able to have economic involvement in the world. Your health actually improves, all of the things that we talked about. I think there was also a question, Charles, about osseointegrated implants, or Baha is a name brand, but when do you use an osseointegrated implant on somebody?
So typically that's meant to treat a conductive hearing loss. So the world of bone conducting hearing is its own large topic, but there's a number of different ways to do this. One is where you place a titanium screw behind the ear, and there's two versions of that, a Baha and a Ponto, but there's also newer devices that are more active drives and more powerful that go under the skin. Those are primarily treating conductive hearing losses, but can also give a little boost to cover some sensorineural loss. There's also a usage where you're treating single-sided hearing loss by bone conducting the sound to the other ear. And so there are a lot of potential things that can be done.
I just want to touch on music and cochlear implants again. So it's my experience as a cochlear implant surgeon that many of my patients after their implant, like the music that they liked before. They somehow don't figure out the new music, but they like the music they liked before. What's happening in their brains? Is it stimulating a happiness center? What's going on in their brains, Charles?
So keep in mind that listening to music or remembering a piece of music is a very, I think, intensely cognitive memory activation where, you know, for example, if right now you think about your favorite song, you can pause and hear it almost perfectly in your head because your auditory memory is very accurate in that way. And so for a cochlear implant user to hear a sound, even if the song is not perfectly delivered from a kind of physics and acoustical energy perspective, it will activate that experience of listening to that song again, and your memory can really assist or boost. On the other hand, if it's a song that you had never heard of before or music that's new to you, it's much harder because there you're just relying on the actual physics and acoustical energy that's being transmitted into your cochlear implant and then to your nerve to try to recreate that experience. And we know it's kind of a relatively poor experience compared to natural hearing.
We're coming up on our last few minutes together. What would be three takeaways for our listeners and our viewers? Shelley, let's start with you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for starting with me. So the three takeaways from my side is, first, protect your hearing. So your hearing is precious and it's fragile. Once it goes, it's not going to naturally come back. So take care of your hearing. Secondly, check your hearing. So check your hearing from time to time. There are amazing tools. WHO has an app called the HearWHO app. Make use of that. It's a free app. There are others out there. Check your hearing using a validated app from time to time. And thirdly, if you have hearing loss, talk about it. Don't hide it. Talk about it so the world knows, and the stigma around hearing loss starts to dissolve. I stop there.
And Charles, how about your takeaways?
I need three new takeaways now. Well, I would say that if one thing the pandemic has made very clear, it's that we need to hear better. And so the first thing I would say, in addition to the things that Shelley pointed out, is to recognize that other people may not hear well. And that might be a reason why it's difficult to communicate with them, and that the impacts of that communication loss can be really dramatic. I think it's also important to recognize that this is an evolving field of medicine. And so we don't have all the answers yet, but we are rapidly learning new ways to try to treat hearing loss. And so in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years, we should hopefully have completely new options available that don't exist today. So realize that there's active work being done to try to improve things. And thirdly, I would say that music, as something which we're, I think, beginning to understand the power of from a therapeutic perspective and a well-being perspective, is just being it's just starting to be unlocked. And so the Sound Health Network is an initiative for the National Institutes of Health and the National Endowment for the Arts, which I'm co-directing through UCSF, to try to improve the understanding of the science of music and its impact on well-being in the brain.
I want to thank you guys so much. We are coming up on our time. And you can wear a mask. Yep, that you can see those.
You can wear a clear mask so that people with hearing loss can read your lips as well.
Uh-huh. So Dr. Shelly Chatha, who is the WHO Director for Programs for the Prevention of Deafness and Hearing Loss, and Dr. Charles Lim, Professor and Chief of Otology at UCSF and President-elect of the American Auditory Society. Thank you so much for joining us. This show can't be done without our team and our producers and executive producers. And finally, you guys, stay tuned for next week. We're going to talk about the back and when do we need to intervene with our back. We have our guest, Dr. Michael Smith, who's a spine surgeon here in New York City, and Dr. Kimberly Sackheim, who's a physiatrist and spine rehab doctor. And it's going to be, that's going to be a great show as well.
Thank you all. Stay safe.